Good afternoon and welcome to the Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Today's show is all about mortgages. If you have questions about buying a home or refinancing an existing home, maybe you're a few payments behind on your mortgage payments and you need a loan modification, or you're actually facing foreclosure, today's show is just for you. Because our special guest is Rob Stearns, President and CEO of Lenders Residential Mortgage, which was founded in 1995. Lenders Residential Mortgage is a mortgage banker, direct lender, a broker, and they offer FHA, VA, jumbo, conventional conforming, and non-conforming loan products. Over the last 15 years, this company has closed several hundred million dollars in mortgage loans. Rob is known as a mortgage expert because he does weekly segments on Heaven 97's KHVN's Community Forum, where he offers mortgage advice to the listening audience. And he also offers workshops and seminars to first-time home buyers. Welcome to the show, Rob. How are you?
Good day, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Listen, you have a very impressive bio. I myself have been in the industry since 1993, but after being a broker for 10 years, myself and a lot of other brokers got out because the industry seemed to be in a never-ending freefall. How have you managed to survive?
Yeah, honey, I was just gonna say it's either it was absolute stubbornness or just the fact that we are very committed to this industry. And you know, Carrie, it has been a free fall for the past 5 years, literally.
Yeah.
We've seen so much craziness happen between the government oversight that's increased so aggressively, to the collapse of the subprime mortgage industry, and of course. Literally the restructuring and rebuilding of the entire mortgage business as a whole. The fact of the matter is, it has been difficult. There's been some ups and downs, but the reality is we are stronger than we've ever been, and we really feel like we're getting a lot of the people out of the business that quite truthfully should have been put out of the industry a long time ago. Regardless, things are really moving in the right direction.
Really? Well, let me ask you, is now a good time for someone to buy a home?
Yes, ma'am. Now is the perfect time for somebody to buy a home, whether it's a brand new homeowner or we're dealing with somebody who is in fact purchasing up to buy maybe a larger home or move to a different area of the city. The fact is, again, right now rates are so unbelievably low. There is so much opportunity available for people to literally make that purchasing decision. Absolutely, this is the right time. Rates are just unbelievably low, and contrary to popular belief, there is a lot of money available for mortgages right now.
Let's ask this question then. Tell us, where are interest rates in terms of if someone was looking for a 30-year fixed mortgage, what would they be looking at?
Sure. Well, it's going to depend, Carrie, to a point whether or not they are looking at an FHA loan, which is a federally backed loan by the government, or a conventional mortgage loan, a VA loan, what have you. But in regular generalities, we're seeing 30-year mortgages in the very low 5% range, 15-year mortgages in the mid 4s. And then, of course, it's going to depend to some extent on the individual's credit as to where those mortgage interest rates may move from there. But still, even with the interest rate overlays out there today, we're not seeing more than maybe a quarter of a point or 3/8 of a point in movement for the worst credit.
Okay. That said, 30-year fixes are pretty much what most people get, but other people sometimes are interested in adjustable rates. Explain to the buyers or any listening audience that may not know what an adjustable rate is. Explain that to the listening audience.
Sure. Well, an acronym for an adjustable rate mortgage would be an ARM or an ARM, and I think we've all heard that term ARM used very loosely over the past many years. An adjustable rate mortgage loan was attributed in large part to the subprime industry, even though, truth be told, the federal government, FHA, has been offering ARMs or adjustable rate mortgages for years, as well as all of your conforming and non-conforming lenders, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or the other people in the marketplace. An adjustable rate mortgage is specifically a mortgage where the interest rate is tied to something other than a fixed period of interest over a specific amortization. In other words, an adjustable rate mortgage may be very well amortized over a 30-year cycle, but a limited time, whether it's a 2, 3, 5, 7, or 10-year period, could be quite literally fixed at a certain interest rate that is, in many cases, lower than current market and will adjust based on an index that is tied to a margin after the expiration of that fixed period. So, in other words, you may see a 60-month fixed-rate mortgage that will then begin to fluctuate after the expiration of that 60-month initial term.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when people are put on adjustable rates, a lot of times they don't even understand that it may go up or down based on what's going on in the market, and it actually does have a cap that it can go up to. Can you explain that
right.
a little bit to them, how it can cap out?
Sure, Carrie. A adjustable rate mortgage, or sometimes called a variable rate mortgage, is traditionally going to have a cap meaning a ceiling as far as how high that mortgage can go. So as an example, on a mortgage loan that has a 5-point cap, it may start out at 3.75%, but it has a cap over the lifetime of 5 points, meaning it will never go higher than 8.75. During the adjustment periods, which in many cases are either 6 months or 12 months after the expiration of that initial fixed rate term, that mortgage can in fact fluctuate, and usually the fluctuation will be tied to maybe LIBOR or a cost of savings index or something other than a fixed rate period that would be attached to a margin. So right now what we're really seeing is some adjustable rate mortgages carry starting out, again, in the mid-threes or even the high threes, but they will have the ability to adjust after the expiration of that fixed period. And that's not a bad thing if an adjustable rate mortgage is used properly. The big difficulty we got ourselves into several years ago is that there were a lot of borrowers who were using those adjustable rate mortgages to get themselves in with a payment that they couldn't afford when the mortgage began to manipulate or it began to move higher. So in other words, maybe they could afford the first 2 years of a mortgage loan carry at that low interest rate. But when it began to adjust, whether it was a 1-point adjustment or a 2-point adjustment, it just knocked them out of their debt-to-income ratio comfort zone. They couldn't afford those houses, and that's what was attributed in large part to the subprime mortgage industry.
So the listener should understand that there's a negative and a positive to get an adjustable rate. It just depends upon your specific situation, correct?
Yes, ma'am. I would actually even go to the extent of saying that adjustable rate mortgages are in most cases a very positive opportunity for the consumer if they are properly educated about how to use that to their benefit. It's going to be really a matter of how long are you planning on staying in your home, how much are you comfortable in spending every month, how much do you spend outside of your credit report, because as a mortgage lender there's a lot of things that we don't get the chance to see. I don't know how much the individual spends on child care. I don't know how much they may spend on dining out or on their college son's tuition or their high school daughter's driver's education or whatever it may be. So there are always mitigating costs and ancillary expenses that we can consider, and unfortunately those are usually the things that end up being a difficulty. As you know, in the mortgage industry, you clearly said you were in the industry for quite a while and you've seen things change and come and go. The biggest problem that we've always had to deal with is the fact that there is an absolute intangible and unknown as it relates to the consumer's expenses that we just flat can't get our arms around, and that's the whole reason why we operate with debt-to-income ratios, to try and compensate for that unknown.
Okay, that said, and I do want to deal with debt-to-income ratio just down the road a bit, but right now if someone is in a situation in which they got, let's just say, on an adjustable rate several years ago and it has gone up and up, which typically that's not going to be the case dealing with the market we're dealing with now, but if that were and the rate was going up and they were considering refinancing, Can you explain to them when you're refinancing, what is a good time to refinance and when isn't, based on like the interest rates that you have, based on the interest rates you have and the interest rates you're trying to go to? Does
sure.
it need to drop a certain percentage point in order to make it worth your while? Or if you're going like maybe from a 30-year to a 15-year because you're cutting down the term, can you explain
yes,
to them the differences in refinancing?
Absolutely. We are seeing quite a bit of refinance activity still in this market. The main reason is because rates are so low. But the general rule of thumb is that you want to see at least a 1 percentage point difference between your current interest rate that you're paying on your home and the new proposed interest rate. Now, with that being said, and with that understanding, the reality is that in many cases, as you indicated, people are refinancing their mortgage loans for the purpose of cutting their term down. In other words, going from a 30-year term mortgage where they may have 28 years left to pay, all the way down to a 10 or 15-year mortgage, and in that case, they could save quite literally tens of thousands of dollars just in overall mortgage loan interest over that period of time. You know, another reason we're seeing people refinance right now is really the unknown factor of where rates will go to in the long term. Because, Carrie, so often right now we're actually seeing these adjustable rate mortgages adjust downwards because of current market conditions. However, as we all know, and I guess it's the general law of physics, what goes down must come up, and vice versa. So we know that even though these adjustable rate mortgages may actually be adjusting downwards, providing temporary relief to the borrower, they're going to go up in tandem with the rest of the fixed rate market. So, in other words, if somebody is planning on writing this adjustable rate mortgage for the next year or two, they could very well find themselves refinancing into a much higher rate fixed mortgage just because the entire market is going to shift, and we're already seeing some significant corrections to interest rates over the past few weeks. We've seen things begin to correct.
Well, let's just say someone is interested in purchasing a home. Can you explain to the listening audience how the mortgage processors and underwriters look at the debt-to-income ratio? Explain to them how that factors into whether or not they can qualify for that house or not.
Sure. A debt-to-income ratio, or DTI, quite literally means the identifiable debt that we can assess to a consumer based on their credit report as it relates to their verifiables that show up on a credit report plus the cost of their mortgage, and then we apply that to the amount of documentable income. And there's a couple of really key words there that we want to focus on. One is documentable income.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay if a borrower makes money that is quote-unquote off the books or that we can't document directly, but the fact is we can't use that in qualifying them. The days of those stated income loans and bank statement-driven mortgages have all gone, and now everything has to be fully documentable, meaning W-2s, paycheck stubs, tax returns for the past several years. So if we can't document the income, then it doesn't exist from the underwriter's perspective. Now, the other thing to focus on is going to be verifiable debts, meaning if the debt doesn't show up on the credit report, we don't know it exists unless the borrower tells us. And that's the whole reason why we work with a debt-to-income ratio to start with, because we try and take into consideration or into an account that there is additional debt that we don't know about, but we have no way of really putting our finger on it unless the borrower exercises some level of control or restraint in taking that mortgage because of these debts that only they can identify. Nobody else knows where they are. It's not showing up on a credit report.
So there is a such thing as buying too much house for yourself. I mean, you can be buying too much house for what you
sure make. And. Yes, ma'am, and you know what? In the long run, again, as you've experienced personally from your time in the industry, nobody can really control how much house is too much house for the consumer other than that consumer, because there are so many intangibles, there are so many things that we just don't know in this industry. There's so much that we have no direct control over. Again, the college tuition for the kids or the preschool tuition or the grandchild or what have you. There are so much that we can't control. We don't know when somebody's really committing themselves to too much of a house payment other than by looking at their documentable income and their verifiable debt.
I agree with that. So I heard you allude to the fact that some of the type loans that had gone through in the past may not be going through today. So are you saying that there's no longer going to be creative financing out there for the buyers?
Not creative financing that we were used to several years ago. A lot of that creative financing was actually made available through non-traditional lending sources or non-conforming mortgages, meaning mortgages that were not necessarily backed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or the federal government, whether that be VA, USDA, or FHA. So now everybody has to pretty well document their income through paycheck stubs, W-2s, and income tax returns, and we don't have the ability anymore to, like you said, creatively build a mortgage loan around a stated income borrower, even if that borrower may have an 800 credit score. That has absolutely no impact in the eyes of the underwriter whatsoever. When it comes to documenting income, we have to have verifiable, documentable income, and that's what we're going to underwrite a loan off of.
Okay, are we seeing 100% finances today like we did back in the day, or is that over?
Well, not in the same sense of the word. It was 3 years ago we were seeing 100% financing even on subprime mortgages that were being underwritten through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, as well as these non-conforming lenders. There are still 100% financing programs out there. However, 100% financing now is going to be limited directly to either a VA loan, in which case all of our veterans are eligible to receive 100% financing, or a USDA loan, which is the United States Department of Agriculture. USDA will back loans in certain specific geographic areas at 100%. But other than that, there are no 100% programs that are truly available any longer. That whole market has been written off in large part as just too risky, and most everybody has opted to restrict lending to no more than 97%.
Wow. That said, credit score and trying to get into a home has changed in terms of what was acceptable a year ago or 2 years ago. Those credit scores need to be a little higher. Is that not correct?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
What type
Absolutely.
Of credit score could be the absolute lowest possible interest rate?
Well, to get the absolute lowest interest rate, again, it's going to depend on whether we're looking at an FHA loan or a conforming loan. But in general, once we see a credit score over a 740, and that's a mid-score, I have to point that out because there are literally three true repositories that report Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. As a mortgage company, we're going to take the middle of the three numerical values, meaning if someone's got a 700, a 750, and an 800 score, we're going to use the 750 to qualify them. But any time a borrower has a score of at least a 740, they are generally going to be eligible for the best or most attractive products out there in the marketplace. Now, with that being said, truly the proper way to look at this, because most people are not going to be in that category from a credit perspective, just given the sign of the times. Really, the best way to look at it, Carrie, is how low a credit score can we go? And there are programs right now that will go down to a 580 credit score. Actually, FHA is still a 580 credit score in very specific instances. And the positive thing about that is that to get a 580 credit score, you don't have to have perfect credit. You just have to be creditworthy enough to be consistent with your current outstanding debt. In most cases, 580 score is somewhat readily attainable.
Okay. For the borrower who has maybe just like a 560, let's just say, and needing to get that extra 20 points and they were trying to clean up their credit, do you ever advise them to use credit repair services?
Well, credit repair is kind of a sticky wicket, really, Carrie. I think that the biggest problem we see with these credit repair companies right now is that the way that they will try and repair somebody's credit is literally by going in and just disputing everything on that credit report, which can be effective. The only problem is that now in the automated underwriting engines that we all use to underwrite a file, we have to ignore any trade lines that have disputes noted on them on the credit reports. What that means literally is that if a consumer is trying to go through credit repair, and even if their credit score may have jumped by that 20 points, I can't offer them an automated underwriting approval because they have disputed trade lines. That knocks the whole file down to a manual underwrite, which is going to give us much lower debt-to-income ratio requirements. And if, in fact, we can get the individual consumer qualified, it will be for much less of a house. So normally when it comes to credit restoration, we will do a lot of that in-house. We do a lot of that ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the reason we do it ourselves, Carrie, is because we can literally make sure that this credit is being taken care of properly. Most of the time, credit repair and restoration work is really more a matter of credit rebuilding than anything else. You know, the biggest problem a consumer has with their credit is not necessarily how to get rid of all the old nasty credit if in fact there is bad credit on there. It's the fact that even if you get rid of the old bad credit, you have to have some good credit on there to take its place. Otherwise, the scores are hollow and they mean absolutely nothing.
So is there a certain sequence in which people should pay off of their accounts in order to bring up their scores?
Yes, ma'am. There sure is. Traditionally, we will tell the borrower that you want to pay off the newest or the freshest debt first. Meaning, when we go through and qualify a borrower or a consumer, the first thing we're going to do is pull their credit, and the second thing we're going to do is take a look at their income to make sure that they can literally afford to purchase the acquisition, the home that they're wanting to buy. Now, once we know that they can afford the home from a debt to income perspective, we will go in and look at that credit report and identify the newest or the most recent negative reporting credit, if in fact it's on there, and we will recommend that they take care of those debts before the older debts, because the ones that don't report any longer, carry the ones that don't report to that credit bureau anymore, let's say maybe they charged off in 2008 and they stopped reporting in 2009, don't have as much of an impact on that individual's credit score as a debt that is reporting currently because it just charged off 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to knock out the newest debt first, and there are some other little idiosyncrasies in credit restoration or credit rebuilding that can bring somebody's score up very quickly as well.
Okay. Well, then there's a lot of people that have gotten behind on their mortgages due to the economy and loss of jobs and some other things, maybe medical conditions. If they've gotten like a couple of payments behind, let's just say, and they're needing to do what's called a loan modification, can you explain a loan modification?
Sure. You know, a loan modification is really, really a restructuring of the existing outstanding mortgage loan, meaning that right now the federal government in certain instances, and I really want to preface that by saying certain specific instances, because it is always up to the individual lender as to whether they will allow a modification or not. But in certain instances, the lender will take the amount of the debt that is owed and modify the loan by putting that debt, the arrearages, into a new mortgage balance, increasing the amount of the loan, and then reamortizing it over another 30-year cycle. In many cases, that reduces the overall monthly payment to the borrower and helps them get caught up. But again, we want to stress, Carrie, that these lenders are very selective and do not have to do this. And in many cases, part of what we talk about on the radio so often is the fact that these lenders will literally offer different strokes for different folks, meaning they may offer to do this for consumer A but not for consumer B just because they're not obligated to do it, and it may not be as beneficial to them. So I never would recommend anybody make a foregone conclusion that they can get that loan modification before they speak to their existing lender. But clearly, that's the first stop if, in fact, someone is behind on that mortgage.
That said, if you are getting behind and you're trying to get a loan modification, there has been what I call some misinformation out there that tells people just go ahead and stop paying the mortgage, period, and then you'll qualify for that. Would you suggest that to someone who is getting a little behind on your mortgage to just stop completely making the mortgage payment?
You know, and that's really kind of crazy. And you're right. I've heard that many times from a variety of different consumers as it relates to different banks and savings institutions. I would never recommend that somebody who is not behind on their mortgage let themselves get behind just for the sake of trying to get into a loan modification, because clearly that has very long and far-reaching impact on their credit as a whole, which is going to impact them as a consumer for many, many years potentially to come. Sometimes, though, I haven't heard it told to individuals that we can't do a loan modification for you because you're current on your mortgage, which is kind of silly. It's like penalizing a consumer for actually paying their bill.
It actually is. But doesn't the government have some loan modification programs that they're offering right now?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Well, the government, and I like.
Go ahead. How does it work?
Well, so I was going to explain to you. The government does sponsor various programs, but those programs are not mandatory. They are selective.
Okay.
So these institutions that carry the mortgage can elect not to offer these loan modification products. More importantly, they operate differently from one savings bank to another savings bank, meaning Bank of America could be entirely different than Wells Fargo, and they can vary from Chase, and they vary within these individual companies because they have the ability to put certain overlays as far as requirements are concerned. So it's not going to be the same with every individual in every bank. I think that the best thing we can recommend for our listeners as far as loan modification is, if you are in fact behind on your mortgage, the smartest thing to do is to communicate with your existing lender, get to a supervisor within that lender, because another issue that we're dealing with is a lot of these banks are ramping up and hiring people so quickly. They're hiring minimum wage people in many cases and not properly educating them on how to communicate with the borrowers. Talk to a manager. Tell them and explain your situation. If you're behind, if you can't get any relief through that scenario, then clearly we all always have the right, certainly in Texas, to protect ourselves via taking legal measures and seeing an attorney.
You know, with that government assistance program for the loan modifications, what percentage of the people have actually been helped through that?
Oh, wow. Now, you know, that's a very leading question, and I have to acknowledge the fact that it's been very, very disappointing to us as an industry, from the whole perspective. The numbers that we have seen were that the government initially projected it would help many millions of consumers, and to date it's been maybe less than 100,000 as a whole that have benefited from it, or in other words, less than 7% of what was originally projected would benefit from these loan modifications. That's why I'm saying it's very selective, and I think that still from my perspective, just in offering somebody the opportunity to try and protect their asset, I would always keep a conversation with an attorney in the background just to make sure that you don't end up losing what is in many cases your biggest asset you'll ever acquire, and that's your home.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Rob, does your company do reverse mortgages?
Yeah, we do have the ability to do reverse mortgages. We really don't do a lot of reverse mortgage work for a variety of reasons, but principally there are reverse mortgages available in the marketplace, and in very specific instances, a reverse mortgage does make sense to the borrower.
Can you explain that term, reverse mortgage, to the listeners?
Sure. A reverse mortgage is a mortgage where the borrower has the ability to stop paying a monthly mortgage note, but that note is still going to be amortized on the back. So I guess the best way to explain this, Carrie, would be to say that somebody may own a house that's worth $200,000 and they have no debt on it whatsoever. Well, they are allowed within underwriting guidelines to maybe borrow up to 70% of that appraised value, or on a $200,000 house, that would be $140,000. Well, the payments on that $140,000 are not due up front like they would be on a traditional mortgage. Rather, it's entirely reverse of that, and those payments are going to accrue on the back of the mortgage note, increasing how much they owe. So that $140,000 over time will very, very likely, and almost absolutely increase from $140,000 exponentially, depending on how long the consumer lives or what have you. Now, I want to also add that on a situation like this, if there is no debt owed on that house, Carrie, they would be getting $140,000 in their hands right up front through the home equity portion of available funds.
If I'm 39, I can't qualify for a reverse mortgage.
Well. No, ma'am. No. Usually, reverse mortgages are going to be reserved for people that are 66 years and older. And how much they can borrow against the home's equity is going to be driven entirely by their age, and they're not necessarily going to have to worry about qualifying from an income perspective. Rather, there will have to be an appraisal done.
Okay. The term interest-only loan has been something that's been out there for a minute now, and a lot of people are getting on those, but I think some are being deceived about how an interest-only loan really works. Can you explain an interest-only loan?
Sure, and I'll tell you the positives and the negatives to it, because quite honestly, an interest-only loan is really a loan that's been out there for a long time, although it was for many years used as an instrument for banks as far as how they financed equipment, things of that nature, where the borrower literally just pays interest only and then repays the full principal. An interest-only loan is quite simply put, a loan where you pay only interest on the amount of money that's borrowed. So that means that rather than fully amortizing the principal and the interest over the life of the loan, you're going to make just an interest payment and no principal reduction while the interest-only period is continuing. So on a $100,000 loan, if somebody was paying 5% interest only, they would be paying $5,000 annually or roughly $415 per month to borrow that $100,000. The only thing is that at the end of that interest only period, they would still owe $100,000 unless they dissipate a portion of that principal. Now, the benefit to an interest-only loan is that you have the ability to pay principal down very, very quickly on an interest-only loan because you traditionally can pay as much as you want towards that principal amount owed, and the loan will reamortize every time you make a principal payment. In other words, if you borrow $100,000 and you pay $10,000 towards principal, you're now going to be charged interest only on $90,000.
Okay.
So you can see very easily how you can pay off your loan much faster if you manage it properly. However, the big difficulty that we found ourselves getting into back in 2005 and 2006 when these loans were so popular is that many people use that interest-only option as a way of minimizing their monthly expense with no attention towards the fact that when the interest-only period expires, they're going to owe as much as they started with. Then you find yourselves in a declining interest rate market, and quite literally what happens, Carrie, is that you are left with a home that in many cases may not be worth as much as you owed on it because you've made no principal reduction whatsoever.
And I think that's happened more often than people realize because, you know, people are attracted to the fact that the payment is lower because, you know, they're just dealing with the interest.
Right, exactly, and that's unfortunately what we've seen many times, especially in an economy. I know here in Texas, we're very blessed in that we've actually seen property values hold somewhat steady. But in many markets, Michigan or Florida or Nevada, what have you, we've seen property roll backwards in some cases as much as 20%. So if you're in an interest only loan and you had financed a loan at 95% to begin with, and you've lost 20% of the original appraised value, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. I see. So how long can they stay on an interest-only loan?
Well, right now we actually offer terms as long as 10 years on an interest-only basis.
Right.
So you can be interest-only for up to 10 years depending on how you negotiate the interest-only cycle right up front, but it is going to be variable from one loan product to another.
Then they'd have to refinance out of the interest-only loan if they were going to continue to stay in that house and get a fixed rate or an adjustable rate of some type.
Traditionally, yes, ma'am. Traditionally, after the interest-only period expires, then the debt reduction becomes so expensive that they want to refinance out of that and move into a regular 30-year mortgage or something along those lines.
Bob, how long is it taking someone to close a loan today?
Right now, we're seeing an average loan closing take about 3 to 3.5 weeks. Now, I also want to add that those numbers are up probably by about 10 days from where they were several years ago. It's taking longer to close loans now because we are having to be much more diligent in the underwriting of these loans, and much more aggressive in making certain that we have everything documented accurately, just because of all of the pushback legislation that's come through the government as it relates to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and FHA here lately.
If someone is interested in purchasing a home and they're not sure exactly how much they're going to need to set aside for the purchase of a home, can you give them a scenario in which they have a percentage in which they need to set aside when they're getting ready to buy a home?
Sure, Carrie. Right now, the average mortgage loan is going to require 3.5% down. That's an FHA loan. And right now, FHA will allow you to finance up to $271,050. That means that on an FHA loan, you would put down 3.5%, and that would be your only monetary commitment to that loan. And in many cases, that 3.5% has to be the borrower's own funds, and potentially it can be borrowed depending on how high your credit score is with FHA. So in some cases, we are actually seeing people get in where they've borrowed the entire amount of funds. But traditionally, we would recommend that the borrower put aside at least 3.5 to 5% to cover their down payment and any residual closing costs that are not being paid for by the seller of that property, whether it's a home builder or just a regular owner who is selling the home and moving on for whatever reason.
Okay. Let me ask you, how can a person determine they've got the right mortgage person, the right originator to do their loan? How do you know when you're dealing with a reputable mortgage broker, a banker, or you're not? How do you know?
Well, good question. And I'd like to say, like my father, you go with your gut. But the fact is, these days you can't always go with just your instinct and your gut feelings. Better Business Bureau is a tremendous tool and a tremendous vehicle for ascertaining the credibility and the integrity of the company you're working with. Now, because of recent legislation, everybody in the country is expected to be licensed by the federal government here within the next several months. So that in and of itself is going to be a very significant differentiator as it relates to mortgage loan originators and mortgage companies. If somebody does not have a license, quite literally, Carrie, that means they don't have the same level of education as they are federally mandated. So clearly, if someone is not licensed, I would avoid that individual or that company. With that being said, a lot also has to do with just asking questions as a consumer. Oftentimes on the radio, what we talk about is the fact that the only bad question is the one you don't ask. There's never too many questions for somebody who is whether it's purchasing their first home or financing a home after several they've owned recently. There's never a bad question, and anytime you come up against an originator or a company who is hesitant to answer a question in any way, that is probably again another individual I would recommend you steer clear from.
When someone is actually going in and talking to an originator or a broker for the first time and they have a property in mind, how soon should they be disclosed a good faith estimate?
Well, normally a good faith estimate by law is required to be disclosed within 72 hours or 3 days from the time the individual makes application. That means if you sit down and do a loan application with a borrower, within 72 hours, they should be, per RESPA, They should be receiving a good faith estimate and a truth in lending disclosure document within that 3-day cycle. And I can say from firsthand experience, anytime we disclose or anytime we work with a consumer, whether it is via email or Federal Express or face to face, and we do quite a bit of face to face business, Carrie, we disclose right there on the spot, and actually always we will have the borrower walking out the door if they've come into the office literally with those papers in their hands, because RESPA is really the most important requirement in the mortgage industry. That is what governs the entire mortgage transaction, and there are very specific laws that have to be followed from a disclosure standpoint in order to not only comply but to actually be efficient and effective at the job that we're tasked with.
Okay, that said, I'm given a good faith estimate, and based on the property I'm buying, say it's just a $50,000 property, and I'm looking at these fees, and I'm looking at $5,000-$7,000 in closing cost fees, how do I know when the closing cost fees are excessive?
Wow. Well, that's really going to be a differentiator between what the true acquisition cost of the property is and exactly how much we're putting into it. You know, now, Carrie, with the changes that the federal government has made to our disclosure documents and our good faith estimates, which is a term you should be familiar with, and certainly if any of our listeners aren't familiar with it, a good faith estimate is the document that really controls the whole mortgage transaction. Now the way that we are having to disclose things from a good faith estimate perspective, everything gets rolled literally into closing costs and origination. So it doesn't matter whether it's a processing fee or an application fee or underwriting or literal points in buying down a mortgage loan. It's all going to be disclosed as origination now. So we are seeing much higher origination costs than we used to, just because things aren't differentiated as they were prior to the new RESPA rules that came out at the end of 2009. As far as what is too much, I would venture to say that anytime a consumer is paying more than 3 to 3.5% in closing costs on a mortgage loan over $200,000, they are paying well over what is available in the marketplace, given the fact that their credit is acceptable and there are no other hidden circumstances involved. Oftentimes, the money that a borrower pays in financing a home is going to be directly related to the fact that maybe there are discount points that are involved or other things that are involved to help compensate possibly for a lower credit score or the type of mortgage loan, say a home equity or a cash-out mortgage loan as opposed to a straight refinance rate and term loan.
Okay. We're going to go to the phone lines. If you want to weigh in and talk with Rob about a mortgage question you may have, the number is 347-850-8390. Again, the number is 347-850-8390. We're going to go to 817-507. Good afternoon. Welcome to Center Stage.
Hello, you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I want to know, what's the average credit score that you have to be approved for FHA or VA or conventional loan?
Okay, absolutely, yes, sir. The traditional credit score, or I guess the minimum credit score, would probably be the better answer for you. We will need at least a 580 credit score to be approved for an FHA loan right now, and for a VA or a conventional mortgage loan, depending on how much money you're putting into the transaction on that conventional mortgage loan, we would need to see at least a 620 score. Now, if we're looking to finance on a conventional mortgage loan more than 80%, we would need to see at least a 680 credit score. And that's because of mortgage insurance, not because of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac guidelines, but the mortgage insurance companies will not issue MI or mortgage insurance any longer without a credit score that exceeds 680.
What about a commercial loan?
Commercial loans are going to be an entirely different scenario, and oftentimes commercial loans are not only judged by credit of the primary individual, but they're also going to be judged by things like rent rolls, if in fact it is a commercial office park or office building. They'll be judged also by collateral, meaning whether or not the individual is financing maybe a $1 million property, and they're only trying to finance $300,000 of the transaction. So, really, a commercial mortgage loan is a totally different animal, so to speak, than a residential mortgage loan. I would venture to say, though, that in a commercial mortgage loan, you're going to want to see at least a 660 credit score, because you do have to have a very strong sense of creditworthiness for the borrower just to offer up any type of approval, even if it is collateralized significantly.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, caller?
Yeah, that pretty well told me what I needed to know. Now I have one more question.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Like if you own a property.
Yes, sir.
And you want to use that property for collateral. Do you have a listing of any builders that use that property as collateral that can go in and build a house for you?
Sir, when you say a piece of, you're speaking about a regular piece of land, in other words?
Yes.
Yeah, there are quite a few builders. There are quite a few builders out there who will take your existing land and build for you on that land. As far as offering you a specific list, I would probably say we're better off doing that in all fairness off the air. If you don't mind, Carrie, I'd like to go ahead and give out my toll-free telephone number, and maybe we can go ahead and address your concerns after the fact, sir.
Okay, do that, Rob, please.
Yeah, yes, ma'am. That toll-free number is going to be 877-888-0463. That's toll-free. 877-888-0463.
And who do I ask for?
My name is Rob, R-O-B, and the last name is Stern, S-T-E-R-N. And I'll be more than happy to point you in any direction needed. So you do have quite a few options, though. It's going to be driven, again, by income or by credit as well. But give me a call, and we'll talk through everything off the air and try and get you going in the right direction, okay?
Okay, and I have one more question. Now,
yes,
if
sir.
You're purchasing property for an investment purpose, like as a tax shelter or something, is this criteria still the same as buying a regular residential home?
No, sir.
Somewhere
that
you're not going to live, but it's going to be
investment property,
tax write-off.
Yes, sir. Yeah, investment properties carry a different set of criteria. Investment properties need to carry a larger down payment commitment, traditionally at least 10%, and in most cases 20%. That's going to carry a much higher credit score criteria. Normally we need to see at least a 680 credit score, if not higher, on an investment property. And most importantly, on an investment property, you're going to have to be able to cash flow that investment property as well as all of the other property that you own through traditional documentation. So I can't give somebody, and we won't give anybody credit for the fact that it may be a rental property before we actually have 2 years of verifiable rental income on that piece of property that's being acquired.
Okay. Do you have many property sellers that's paying closing for people?
Right now, pretty much what we're seeing in every transaction are seller-paid closing costs being contributed actually to the maximum. FHA traditionally will allow 6% in seller-paid closing costs, and conventional, if you're financing over 90%, will require or allow up to 3% in seller-paid closing costs. So yes, we are seeing seller-paid closing costs in pretty much every transaction right now.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
Rob, let's talk about investors for a minute. There was a time when investors could flip properties for a significant profit, and they really didn't have to hold on to the properties very long. What is the current situation with that today? Can an investor buy a house today, put $10,000 in it, and flip it for a $50,000 profit with getting a mortgage on it?
Sure. I mean, that'd clearly be a best case scenario, but I think what we're seeing, actually for a fact, what we're seeing right now is that everybody is going back and taking a look at acquisition price on these investor-owned properties. Now, while the government and everybody else acknowledge that in this kind of an economic downturn or slump in many areas, homes are being acquired at a very attractive price, if an investor is going to plan on turning that home in a very quick period of time and making a sizable or significant profit, they have to be prepared to go ahead and document not only their original acquisition price of that property, Carrie, but they're also going to have to be able to document any modifications that they've made to that home since their ownership to justify the increase in price. Otherwise, it's traditionally thought right now that if there's an increase over 20% of acquisition, it's going to be a problem, and the investors who or the mortgage companies who underwrite these investor loans rather are not going to accept the consumer as a creditworthy loan that they will underwrite. In other words, to answer your question directly, no, you can't buy and flip homes like you used to be able to and make money without having very specific documentation to support the transaction.
Is there a certain limit on how many pieces of investment property you can have and then purchase another property with needing financing for it, let's just say?
Yeah, most of our underwriters, most of our investors that we represent require no more than four pieces of investment property, although we do have a few outlets that will go up to 10 pieces of investment property. So it's really going to be more of a mortgage company specific guideline, and that varies. We actually have several different areas and several different groups of investors that we sell our paper to, our closed loans to, as a direct lender, and everybody has a different set of criteria. But traditionally, I would say you don't want to own more than four investment properties plus your primary residence.
Gotcha. Rob, right now we've seen a lot of foreclosures on the market, and that is creating the opportunity for people to get a lot of good deals out there. That said, can you explain to the listeners what the best house on the worst street means in terms of if you find a great piece of property and you got the best house on the worst street, how that affects your resale value?
Sure. you never want to own the best or the biggest house on the worst street. And you never want to own the smallest house on the best street. You know, really what ends up happening is when appraisals are done and values are assessed, they are assessed based on commonality of a neighborhood, meaning comparable sales traditionally within a half a mile or a 1 mile radius. So quite literally, if you own the biggest or the best house in a rough neighborhood, you're going to be penalized on a square foot basis when it comes time to appraise that home, just because there's not like comparables in the neighborhood that will support the value similar to the home that you may be purchasing or trying to refinance. Conversely, you don't want to own the smallest home in a neighborhood of very large homes, because you're going to be met with the same problem, comparable sales. Normally, we want to see comparables within a one-half mile to a mile radius, and on rural properties, we can go up to a five-mile radius, but we really will not go outside of that type of a geographic market area to try and find comparables. So you have to be very cognizant of where you fall within that geographic area in purchasing a home or refinancing a home. You never want to be the biggest house on the block, and you never want to be the smallest.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone lines, Rob. We're going to go to 217-819. Welcome to the show. Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. 217-819. I think they may not. We may be having some difficulties with that one. We'll go back to that call in just a second. Rob, so with the foreclosure situations being what they are, and do you see the industry coming back in terms of the market basically stabilizing where values are where they were supposed to be before all the investors came in and flipped so many properties and got all the numbers off? Do you feel it's going to correct itself? I guess that's my question. Is the market correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I believe we've gone through a huge correction here over the past 18 months to 2 years. And I do believe that the marketplace is realigning itself. I think in many markets across the country, we are seeing property values come back down to where they should be. We've seen tremendous market escalation in markets like Florida and of course Illinois and other states where things just got absolutely out of control. Arizona, Nevada, where we saw per square foot values going up to $300-$400 almost in a record period of time within 1 to 2 year cycle. So we've seen property values readjust in many of those markets. Other markets, property values have been hit terribly, and they're starting to come back up, like Michigan or even some of the other some of the southern states, Louisiana, possibly Arkansas. So what is happening is this is a self-correcting marketplace where property values will again start to rise consistently across the board throughout the United States. It's just going to be a matter of interest rates keeping pace and individuals being able to qualify for these loans, which quite truthfully is starting to happen right now. We're really seeing the mortgage market soften up significantly with rates this low. There's been a tremendous or a record number of people purchasing homes and refinancing homes here certainly in our state, which is Texas, over the past 12 months.
Okay, we're going to go back to the phone lines. We're going to go to 817-451. You're on the line with Rob Stern.
Yeah, I missed the first part of the show. I was wondering, did you talk about reverse mortgage?
Yes, sir.
We did. Rob, can you go over reverse mortgages just a little bit for him?
Sure.
But I wanted one specific aspect of that reverse mortgage. Sometimes when you do the reverse mortgage, you can have income coming into you besides the other stipulations. What is the criteria
Yes.
for where there's income coming to you where you get a check every month?
Yes, sir. Well, actually, a reverse mortgage by its very nature is designed to alleviate your monthly expenditure for a mortgage. So, in other words, on a reverse mortgage, you stop paying your monthly mortgage note. Now, more importantly, a reverse mortgage if there is equity in that house, a reverse mortgage will literally give you cash in hand. In other words, no different than a home equity loan. You'll be able to take equity out of that house, and you won't have to repay the debt whatsoever until you pass or choose to sell the property or what have you. So, quite literally, the criteria is that on a reverse mortgage where you are gaining or you are taking equity out of that transaction, you will not have to pay that back for not only extended period of time, but you'll continue to accrue interest on the back end of that mortgage. And you can elect to take payments on a monthly basis if you prefer, although I think right now, given our current economic environment, it makes more sense to take a lump sum payout if that's what you're able to do, and invest it in some sort of a financial instrument that's going to pay you more than the market.
Well, that's a question
right.
on that then, Rob. There is a backside to the reverse mortgages. If you have heirs, once you pass on, what is the situation with them getting the property back from, let's just say, the bank, because the bank will be currently have possession of the property then. Is that not correct?
Yes, ma'am. You're exactly correct, Carrie. The bank will own that property in its entirety, and when somebody passes, the heirs will have to literally go back in and refinance that reverse mortgage into somebody's name in the family, an heir or what have you, or sell the house straight out in order to maintain ownership of that home. Additionally, what we're seeing happen more often than not now, especially with this kind of economic downturn, is that when the reverse mortgage is actually brought due, the amount owed on the reverse mortgage is more than the actual value of the home. So we're seeing a lot of people walk away from those homes and as heirs and choose not to repurchase the house because they physically or quite literally can't qualify to buy a home that is worth less than what is owed.
Exactly. Well, y'all, this has been another segment of Center Stage, and I have enjoyed talking with Rob Stearns. I've learned some things, and I've been in the industry a long time myself. Rob, thank you so much for being our guest. I hope we have informed somebody who's trying to buy a house or trying to refinance a house. Can you tell them how they can reach you again, Rob?
Yes, ma'am, if I may. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to visit with you as well, honey. My telephone number toll-free is 877-888-0463. That's 877-888-0463. I'm also available via the Internet 24/7, and that is www.lendersresidentialmortgage.com.
Wow. Thank you guys for listening today. I have enjoyed myself thoroughly. This is like visiting with an old friend, Rob, because this is a subject I know a lot about, too. So thank you so much.
Thank you, honey. You have a blessed day. I appreciate you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yes, ma'am. Bye-bye.